One of the interesting questions and also tensions sometimes in Buddhist practice is between instant gratification or delayed gratification. Is Buddhist practice about something we're supposed to realize immediately, right here and now? Or is it something that we are to realize someday, if we huff and puff enough, if we work at it and develop ourselves and do the kind of inner work that eventually leads to some kind of something great? And I think and I hope that the answer is that it's both. It shouldn't be considered one or the other. I came back Friday from having taught a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. And it was really a lovely thing to do, to be a teacher and to be there for this retreat. It's a month-long silent retreat, so the people who are retreatants are in silence and spend pretty much the whole day engaged in their meditation practice, either sitting meditation, which is done about, I don't know how many, there's probably about 9-10 periods of sitting meditation each day, and then maybe about 5-6 periods of walking meditation, and meals are done in silence, so the idea is to, in a sense, be mindful or meditate while you're eating. And one of the things that was quite remarkable near the end, the last days of the retreat, was that when I was doing interviews for people, and people would come in, the interviews stopped being about something else, about the difficulties they had earlier in the day or yesterday on their retreat practice, or what they might be able to do. But you know, it wasn't about advice I can give them. Oh, when you go back to meditate, so in half an hour, then at that point you might try this and that. And the encounter with the retreatant stopped being about something different than the meeting of what was happening right there in the room. And because some of these retreatants, at least, just being alive, just being present, was completely full and complete and enough. And they weren't looking for something else. They weren't trying to change something. They were just very present and alive for this moment. So now I'm telling you about something else, something that happened a few days ago. And so one of the questions is, what is the opportunity that we have to meet here? What does it take to be present as if maybe this is enough? We're present for this experience right here in some full and complete way, so that this Dharma talk is not about what you can do when you get home to meditate. So the question in Buddhism always is, what is it to wake up? And I love the expression waking up, because in my mind, waking up is something that doesn't require anything to change or to be different. You just wake up to it. You're awake to what's happening. So the end of this month-long retreat, there's a lot of diligent work that went into the retreatant's practice. And certainly there were a lot of challenges people had to face in order to be able to show up and be present and alive in a very simple way. And the challenges, for the most part, were their own, were their what they brought with them in their own psyche, their own minds. And what's remarkable about the retreat environment is that there are very few distractions, not the normal distractions. There's no television or newspapers. There's no social conversations. There are no, there's all these kind of things that people do in daily life don't happen there. So you could say there aren't distractions. But the other thing is that there aren't the easy ways of getting present. And there are many ways which are kind of easy. I mean, some people, for example, will exercise, go for a run. You can go for a long run. If you decided to run from here up to Skyline, all of you would be very present at some point between here and there. Some of you, all your normal concerns would fall away by the time you got to Hudson, which is about 4 blocks away. And just breathing would be all you could do. And some of you, in better shape, would get as far as 280, but it's between here and there. Some of you would really, it's one way, kind of really showing up and letting go of, letting everything drop. I was seeing a movie many years ago, a documentary of a man who used to do something like motorcycle racing. But when he had children, he decided he should stop doing that. He didn't have time for motorcycle racing. I guess it takes a lot of time. But he still needed a way to kind of clear his mind, because the motorcycle was kind of racing kind of cleared his mind, and he kind of emptied himself, and so he could really be kind of de-stressed and present. So he needed something to do a much quicker way. So what he did was parachute diving, kind of. He would go early in the morning, before it was still dark. He would climb over the fence to construction sites where they were building skyscrapers, and then he would climb up, skyscrapers pretty high. And then he'd have this kind of parachute, kind of like glider, and on his backpack, and he would unfurl it and he'd jump off the top, and then just fly into the city streets, and there'd be a getaway car for him to take him away. And he said, by the time I reached the bottom, my mind was clear. So that was a lot faster. He'd be back in time for breakfast and he'd be clear. So, in normal life, normal life is very distracting. There's also many ways that you can get to kind of clear your mind and be very present just here. And, jumping off skyscrapers is one. Some people have all kinds of ways that people do that. Some of them are healthy, some not so healthy. Sometimes it's the crises of life that do it. That somehow, someone dies or you're in some serious accident, and all kinds of stuff kind of gets cleared away that seems superfluous, and you find yourself very luminously present, very clearly present. This is really important, this meeting, this situation. But on retreat, there isn't that... you're not given wonderful things. You're not given jumping off skyscrapers, or you're not given kind of dramatic things to kind of make you show up. It's really ordinary. It's kind of, you're in this big room with a lot of other people who have their eyes closed, and you're not talking, and you're not running around, doing all kinds of exciting things. It's actually very unexciting. It's in some descriptions, it's probably one of the most boring things you can do, a meditation retreat. But because it's so simple, what it takes to show up and be present for this moment fully means we have to somehow come to terms with many of our inner psychological tendencies to be distracted, to be afraid, to be lost in stories and fantasy, and to all kinds of things that arise. And so we have to really deal with ourselves rather than kind of have it done quickly, be zapped somehow. And so there's a lot of inner work that gets done. But then that inner work then, if you do it well, leads to something which maybe was always available, which was this moment here. Here we are, Sunday morning. And what is it? Is it possible that this moment here together, us, is kind of luminous, special, wonderful? What would it take? What would it take for each of you to find yourself here and know, not bored by what I'm saying, or, you know, not, you know, perplexed, or not wondering when the talk's going to get more entertaining, or get to something really important. You know, I'm sure Buddhism is this big, important religion and has important things to say. So when is he going to get to that? The list. So what it does then is in this kind of, in saying this, is that it puts the responsibility on you to do something. So what is it you need to do to wake up, to be present, to be here in some clear way, the way that's deeply satisfying? If you want to be deeply satisfied or in this moment, you could take responsibility for that. Jumping off skyscrapers is not taking responsibility. That's kind of like using some kind of adrenaline rush to get it. There's a kind of a remarkable discourse in the middle length discourses with the Buddha of a monk who is visited by a deva at night. And I like to think of this as just a record of the monk's dream. In any case, he has this vision, or this deva comes, and and the deva tells him this kind of story. He says, an anthill smokes by night and blazes by day. A Brahmin comes along and says, take a knife, O wise one, and dig into the anthill. So the wise one digs into the anthill and sees a bolt, like a bolt on a door. And he says, a bolt, O venerable one. And the Brahmin says, throw it aside, throw it away, and keep digging. So he keeps digging with his knife. And the next thing he sees is a frog. And he says, a frog, O venerable one. And the Brahmin says, throw it away. Keep digging. So he keeps digging, and then he comes to a forked path in the anthill. And the Brahmin says, throw it away. Keep digging. So he keeps digging. And then he comes to a sieve. And the Brahmin says, throw the sieve away. Keep digging. And then he comes to a tortoise. And the Brahmin says, throw away the tortoise and keep digging. And then he comes across a slaughter block. And the Brahmin says, throw away the slaughter block. And then he keeps digging. And then he comes across a piece of flesh. And the Brahmin says, throw away the piece of flesh and keep digging. So he throws away the piece of flesh and he keeps digging. And he comes across a cobra. And so the digger says to the Brahmin, a cobra, O venerable one. And the Brahmin says, let the cobra be. Do not harm the cobra. Respect the cobra. So here, he's supposed to throw away all these things except the cobra. Or the naga. The word is naga. Naga, sometimes an ancient serpent. It's a very powerful figure. An elephant, a great majestic elephant, sometimes called a naga in these ancient texts. Mythical serpent kind of dragons are called nagas. So it's a very powerful figure. So cobras are very powerful. So this monk has this dream and he goes to the Buddha and says, what was that about? And the Buddha interprets it for him. And the interpretation suggests to me that this monk had a lot of problems with desire. So the Buddha said, the anthill is the human being, is you. And digging, and the knife is wisdom. So you're supposed to dig with the knife of wisdom, with wisdom. And digging is the arousing of energy. So the arousing of energy. Some people think that the imminence of awakening, the imminence of now, of being present, of just being here, should be really easy. The lazy man's approach. Somehow you kind of relax and sit back, it's just supposed to happen. And I think that energy, engagement, is part of being a human being. What is it to be engaged? Maybe something, being awake is also a kind of way of being engaged, of arousing energy. So here, digging is the arousing of energy. And the first thing it comes across is a bolt. And the bolt the Buddha interprets as ignorance. And here you have wisdom meeting ignorance. And he's told to throw away ignorance. And ignorance is maybe the beginning. Understanding ignorance is the beginning of the Buddhist path. You have to understand a little bit how we're ignorant. And the suggestion here is that ignorance is when we look outside of ourselves for happiness. When we look outside of ourselves for the work that needs to be done so we can be present here Sunday morning in Birch Street for our sense of well-being, our happiness. So there's all these ways in which people look outside of themselves, right? Or all kinds of ways in which we blame our suffering on the world around us. You know, I suffer because George Bush, the economy, my mother, my kids. You know, all kinds of things, you know, why we suffer, it's out there. And that's an ignorance. When we turn away from our own hearts, in a sense, our own minds, and see that this problem and the solution is outside. And wisdom is when we throw away that kind of externalization of caretaking for ourselves and begin looking within into our own quality of our own hearts, our own minds, and be the caretakers of it. So you throw away the ignorance. And it's interesting, the ignorance is the bar, the bolt, the lock that stands in the way of doing this kind of work. So sooner or later we come to this juncture where we're up against a dramatic turning the attention around, some dramatic movement. It's almost like a 100-degree turn from directing the attention externally, as if the external world is going to help us or save us, to somehow turning around to where the locus of liberation or awakening or freedom is going to happen, it's going to be. So then he throws away the bolt, and then he sees a frog. And the frog is, in one translation, is defined as despair due to anger. In another translation I know, they just call it anger. So I don't know about frogs, you know, in our culture, frogs are kind of, you know, princes, right? You're supposed to kiss them. In here, you throw them away. But, you know, somehow the toad is associated with anger or despair due to anger. So, in here, the instruction is throw away that anger, throw away that despair. So in what way does despair, despairing about the world, despairing about your condition, or being angry about the world, angry with your condition, prevent waking up to now, to here? To what degree is it kind of veils of frustration or being upset or being angry that how things are? Things should be different. Things should be easier. And then he throws away the frog. And then he comes to indecisiveness. The forked road, the forked path is symbolic for indecisiveness. So I know it's really easy to kind of see where the work is, where the waking happens, what it takes to show up, but to be indecisive about it, to feel like, gee, is it safe to do? Maybe, is it really safe? I mean, if I'm really open and present here, then I'm vulnerable, then someone's going to take advantage of me, or I'm going to let someone in, or it's better to be guarded after all, because then, you know, we stay safe. Or we can be indecisive about whether it's worth the effort, or all kinds of reasons. And somehow indecisiveness has to be overcome. There has to be some commitment or some engagement. And then the next thing he comes across is a sieve. And a sieve, of course, is, you know, you can't hold water. You put water in a sieve and it all drains out. And the sieve is said to be the hindrances. And these are these psychological forces which really drain our energy, drain us away, drain our energy and our vitality. And so they're forces of sensual desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, anxiety, and doubt. And when they operate and grip us, it's a way in which our vitality disappears from us. And I like the word vitality because sometimes these things can energize us. Certainly when you're restless, you can be quite energized. Anxious, you can be quite energized. But it's a kind of, if you're filled with desire sometimes, you can be filled with energy, or filled with anger, you're filled with energy. But it's a kind of energy which is tiring in the long term. It's stressful. That sooner or later you're going to collapse. And then after the sieve, there's a tortoise. The five places we cling to self. The tortoise has these five, you know, the head and the four limbs, and you pull them in to the shell. So it's supposed to be the way, different ways we cling to a sense of self, to ourselves. So we cling to our body, we cling to our feelings, we cling to our perceptions, our thoughts and opinions, our motivations, and to consciousness, to awareness itself. Somehow we cling to those and make them into, this is who I am. And this whole movement of clinging to making this who I am is one of the barriers to being awake. And this can be seem very, very strange, because if someone's going to be, you know, if you're going to wake up, it has to be you, right? Who else is going to do it for you? You know, it's up to you. The I, the me, has to wake up, has to be present. So it's all about me, right? But actually it's not about you. Because there's something about the clinging to the sense of self, or clinging to the one who's going to have a spiritual experience, or the one who's going to be free, which is another barrier to being present here. And I'd like to suggest that being present, waking up here, being content and alive here, makes you in some ways kind of transparent. It's kind of like the usual reference points that we have for, you know, this is for me, and this is for my well-being, this is, you know, I want to wake up. All the usual reference point, this is who I am, this is who it's happening to, kind of disappears. And probably some of you have had that experience, you know, maybe, you know, if you've jumped off skyscrapers. Perhaps there's a few moments there where the normal references of self just, you know, don't relate. A certain kind of sports, for example, you engage in very actively, and you kind of disappear in the activity. And the slaughter block, that's pretty dramatic language. The slaughter block. And the slaughter block, if here, at least for this monk, not for any of you, of course, is sexual desire. So something about sexual desire, which here for this monk is a slaughter block. So he has to throw that away. And then the piece of flesh, which is the last thing to be thrown away, is delight and lust. Delight and lust. What's wrong with delight? Isn't that part of it? Delight, lust, maybe I can understand getting in the way, but delight? There's a way in which there's a kind of an indulging in delight, indulging in enjoyment, even of wonderful states of mind, states of being. But that very indulging is a barrier to the transparency or luminosity or clarity of just being awake. And then the final thing he comes across is a cobra. And this is the thing not to be let go of, not to be thrown away. Let the cobra be. Do not harm the cobra. Respect the cobra. And the cobra is a symbol for a person who has destroyed the outflows or the toxins. All the ways in which our vitality and energy flows out of us, drains out of us. And this is considered to be someone who's enlightened in the Buddhist tradition, someone who has no outflows anymore from the strains. And rather than being someone then who's kind of self-effacing, someone who kind of, you know, is just kind of like not quite there, the person's called a cobra. Isn't that great? Don't get too close. But something is lots of energy, lots of vitality, something is very powerful. So again, the question is here, is there power inside of you? Or is there a cobra in you? And what does it take to tap into that? If the cobra is the symbol for the kind of possibility of waking up and being present right now at 10:30 Sunday morning on Birch Street, what stands in the way of you as a cobra? What stands in the way of your vitality, your wakefulness? So that's the that's the question then. What is it we have to throw away? What is it we have to let drop? What do we have to empty ourselves of? So that something here, something that is, well, not here, but here and every other here, becomes a place where we can feel content, feel happy, feel alive, feel luminous, feel present, where our sense of being and our connection to others in the world is not about the conditions of the world being improved or better or different. So the conditions of the world can be what they are, but our inner freedom is not dependent on the conditions of the world. So what does that take? If it's not, it doesn't have to do with the conditions of the world. Well, it has to do with something in ourselves. And the question is, can we then, what do we have to let go of? What do we have to empty ourselves of? I hope that all of you have had some experience of your life of doing some kind of activity so thoroughly and completely that you felt emptied in the process. And that emptiness felt quite, you know, happy or alive or liberated. It doesn't have to be so spiritual, the emptying. When I was a college student, I used to love taking, in the first couple of years in college, I loved taking exams. Because I would study really hard for a few days, 2 or 3 days, or however long, you know, memorize all the stuff that I promptly forgot after the exam. But I would really, you know, do those engagement, and then I'd show up at the exam time and do these 2 or 3 hour exams, and everything dropped away. It was just me and the exam, you know, me and the paper, and I just did it, you know, as fully as I could, and then I would leave after turning in my paper or my exam, and I was amazed at how peaceful I was. I'd be completely peaceful. I'd walk around feeling kind of stoned. You know, I'd be kind of like, wow, you know, this is an amazing world I live in. Look at that tree. That's an amazing tree there. I didn't notice that tree being so great. And, you know, college exams is a kind of drug. It was really not a drug, but it's just a way of emptying myself. I was so engaged so fully, I emptied myself. I emptied myself of all the concerns I had, worries I had. So it's one thing to empty yourself without doing the inner work of understanding what you're emptying, having circumstances empty you for you. It's another thing to actually do the work of turning around and looking at your mind well enough to really understand what it is that you're trying to empty yourself from. To do the work of really understanding the mind and grappling with what's there. To grappling with desire or fear or aversion or conceit or the many things that kind of are there kind of being barriers, filters to waking up and being present. And sometimes it's hand-to-hand combat to do this. It's not easy. I think it's important to have tremendous respect for the very great power of some of these forces in our minds that keep us from being here, and it's just here, appreciating this moment. And you see it on retreat, that the degree to which, you know, this month-long retreat, how in some of the people there, it was a incredibly difficult and arduous undertaking. Nothing was asked of them except to sit down, be quiet, and wake up. be present. And not this retreat, but I've known retreats where people have run out screaming. I've known people have panic attacks on retreats. I mean, real panic attacks, serious ones. There was one woman who had, remember one many years ago, who came to me and thought she had, was having a heart attack. Puts me in a difficult situation, you know. I can't really diagnose people medically. But it was pretty clear to me that it wasn't a heart attack. And she just had touched something really painful, really frightening inside of herself. So I stayed with her. We walked around for a while and debriefed her and checked in with her, and pretty quickly it all settled away and never came back, and she's been healthy ever since. That was 12 years ago. And the conditioning of the mind is really, really powerful. So what are your frogs? What are your tortoises and sieves, and what is it that stands in your way? So one of the things that we're asked to do in Buddhist practice is to become very clearly aware, very mindful, attentive to the barriers that we have to waking up, to being present. And not to bypass it and look around, but really clearly understand. And actually, you're sometimes told, if you can throw something away easily, don't. Take your time so you can understand it. So really understand the very things that you don't like about yourself, because they get in the way of your freedom or whatever. Don't be in a hurry to get rid of them, but actually look at them really carefully. Really understand what they are, so you can go through them, so you can dissolve them, so you can resolve them, rather than in some simple way throwing them away. Because sometimes you throw them away too simply, they come right back. So the guy who jumped off the skyscrapers, you know, was good. He was good for, you know, the next week. And then the following weekend, he had to jump off the next skyscraper because he didn't understand how he reconstituted himself. He didn't understand how the forces of attachment and clinging and fear kind of came back into his psyche. And so in Buddhist practice, it's really important to try to understand, how do these forces work in me? How does my sense of self get arise? What are the emotions? What are the beliefs? What are the different things coming into play as I create or form for my conceit, I am whatever, to understand that. So, but does that mean that we have to delay our gratification? We have to delay our awakening because we have to do all this serious work of understanding ourselves and looking at our attachments and our fears, and we have to huff and puff for a month on a month-long silent retreat, or for 10 years, and then eventually we'll kind of discover this cobra, which we just take on faith is in there. Back to the delayed gratification school of Buddhism. So when I took these exams in college, I'd come out of the exam and I'd see these trees in the courtyard, and I'd be amazed at the trees. It was just awesome. Just a tree. It was at UC Santa Barbara, so it was pretty easy because I would go, you know, just walk. Sometimes you almost walk out of the class and you'd see the beach, the ocean. Wow. There's a kind of, I don't know if it's true, but there's a story that sometimes when people on retreat, they see a candy wrapper on the ground, and the candy wrapper is so incredibly beautiful. Wow, look at that. That's an amazing thing. Just the candy wrapper, it's all sparkly and silver. And to really see the candy wrapper as opposed to seeing it through the filter of how could someone have thrown that away and polluted my environment, and that's no respect for me and everybody else, and I got to talk to George Bush and get it fixed. And so as opposed to seeing it for what it is. So one of the things that are really amazing in this world, awesome, that sparkle like candy wrappers, is our anger and our fear and our lust, our distracted mind. Each of those things as they arise is pretty amazing that they should even exist. So rather than seeing it as the problem, they are kind of the problem, they are the obstacles to the cobra, to waking up completely. But how about if seeing them through the perspective of, wow, that's an amazing thing. So not to be in a hurry to get around them or think the problem is to somehow fix them, but simply to kind of wake up and see, wow, isn't that an amazing thing? Isn't it amazing? I don't know exactly why, but the last few days I've been thinking about there was a lot of articles in the paper about the first nanosecond or less of the universe. Remember the thing in the paper? Yes, I know. They had some new discovery a week or two ago, or there was a report of it, that somehow they had discovered astronomers can't seem to get back to the moment when the universe was created, that first instant, but somehow they can get down to something like what happened after the first trillionth of a second. So they're not really content because they don't know what happened at the beginning, but you know, they can get pretty close, you know, fractions of seconds. And so they discovered they pushed the limit back even further. And when everything was like, you know, the whole universe, you know, it was just a pinhead or something. And you know, and so then there's an amazing mystery of what was before. What was before? No wonder people believe in God. But that doesn't help, because what was before God? I mean, where did God come from? You know, where did anything come from? So where did the universe come from? Where did the God come from? Where did it come from? To me, it's mind-boggling. Where did anything come from, this universe? Before that 15, I think it's 14.7 trillion, right? Or 13.7 billion. That's all we are. We're kind of young. The universe. I mean, there's so many more. Anyway, once you start talking about time, it gets weird in the universe. But anyway, so out of this 13.7 or 14 billion years of life of the universe kind of evolving, it comes down to you sitting here thinking about what you're going to have for lunch or reacting to this talk in some way, or getting impatient or being amazed or whatever. It's just, wow, that's what it's come to. So you thought your fear or your anger or your, you know, not to see it as a problem, but to see it as something amazing. To wake up to that. So to use the conditions of our mind as a place to wake up with, as opposed to continuing to see them as the barriers. And then as we wake up to them, at some point we can let go of them, throw them away, or let them empty themselves. So, fellow cobras. Are you ready to be cobras? Do you want to be? What would it mean? I suspect each one of you would be a different kind of cobra. But cobras are fearless, I think. Can you live a life that's fearless and unapologetic? So, those are my thoughts this morning. I hope that I met you all well enough this morning. I am empty enough. Do you have any thoughts? We have a couple of minutes if someone wants to respond or comment or fight. Yes? Is cobra kundalini? Is cobra the same thing as kundalini? Well, certainly that's, cobra is used as a symbol for this energy, this particular kind of energy called kundalini energy. I think that they don't have to be synonyms because it's possible to be brightly, luminously awake and present and not have this powerful coursing energy going through the spine or up through the body in some way.
I know you shouldn't push metaphors too far, but I can't help...
Say that again?
I know you shouldn't push metaphors too far, yeah. But I just can't help but associating deadly danger with a cobra. Is there any significance to that, or is that just off the side?
If I was half the teacher I should be, I would be deadly dangerous for you. But I don't know how to bite. Yeah, it's a high risk. It's a high risk to come to a, Buddha center. It's really high risk sport, high risk, thing. And because ideally, you're supposed to be challenged at the very core of your identity, what you cling to and what you hold on to. So, someone, a really trained cobra can show you exactly, what you're still holding on to, what you need to be freed from. And, but some cobras can only kind of tell you the principle and tell you, look yourself and find out where it is. So it's a little bit safer that way. What do you think? There.
I wanted to continue my clarification of delight and feelings and emotions and just being present in them.
Yes.
And also sexual desire as well. So referring to a previous talk when you talked about selfing.
Did I talk about what?
When you talked about selfing.
Selfing.
So in the story that you gave, you talk about not being attached to delight, and yet, so my understanding of that, which I'm seeking to clarify here, is it's not about being delighted. To be delighted or to be triumphant or to be sad or the full spectrum of feelings and that the state of humanness, it's staying in that, being attached to that. So to make love to one's husband or partner, to be fully in that is to be fully human, to be fully present to that. But to grasp onto it and to run after it every hour or whatever that,
yes.
that is that is my understanding. So there's just this. It's very there's a veil there, of being completely in one's moment of emotion or feeling.
Right.
And then the other side of that, which is barely there, of, almost clinging to it.
Right.
So if you could speak into that, that'd be helpful.
Well, yeah, I think you spoke well enough about it. I think there's a difference between, the issue in Buddhism over and over again is how we cling, whether it's clinging or the resistance. And so, because that's where the suffering is, so when the clinging and the resistance drops away, then the freedom is found right there. And sometimes with so-called positive experiences like delight or happiness, people can feel quite content and happy, I've arrived, and not notice that even there might be a subtle way in which there's still clinging going on, or still some resistance within that state of delight or... And I remember one person on this last retreat had a lot of delight, a lot of joy in her meditation practice, but at some point realized that she was leaning into it, always leaning into it, and it became a barrier for her becoming free. She had to realize how much she was kind of leaning into being soothed and being comforted by the delight. And the language of being fully present for something is often used, and I might use it as well. But it lends itself to the idea that it can lend itself to the idea of something extra. I have to throw myself into it. I have to kind of do something in order to be fully present, and raise myself up and really kind of. And that's very different than the kind of full presence that comes from when we're empty. I still might have energy and be engaged, but we're empty. We're not trying to do anything. We're not trying to be fully present. But we're just there, and we're present because we're empty and there in some simple way. And a lot can happen that way. So my warning to the language you used is even the idea of being fully present you might find in that still some attachment. Hillary, last one.
I sort of struggle with the feeling of passivity that I sort of associate with the idea of just being present. I really understand that the idea of being fully present, especially during meditation practice, but when it comes to engaging with the world, trying to right injustices, or just trying to make the world a better place, it just seems like just being here, being fully awake, seems too passive for me to be able to engage with the world. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it's a fair assessment. I think that if sometimes people, if they get attached to a certain state of being awake, certain degree of freedom, one of the ways of misunderstanding it is to kind of indulge in it or rest in it or hide in it, a variety of things, become passive in it. And a cobra is not passive. A cobra is a symbol of something that's quite active and engaged, I would think. I mean, it's energized, it's an energetic thing. I hope that as people become freer, that it actually frees up the ways in which we're limited or hold ourselves back, so that when we will engage in useful and helpful ways with the world, make us more useful to engage in the world. And there's nothing in inherent in Buddhist teachings that tell us to be passive and just complacent with what's going on in the world. In a very simple summary of Buddhist teachings is the idea that there are two things in Buddhist practice. There's sitting and meditation, and then there's cleaning the temple, sweeping the temple grounds. And the temple doesn't stop at the walls of the temple. They being the whole world, your temple. So those are two things. We take care of the world and we take care of our meditation. And those are the two aspects, if you will, the passive and the active aspects. But hopefully that the passive and active distinction falls away. Certainly in meditation, when people get, when the cobra is awakened, when the concentration and presence and mindfulness gets quite strong, meditation doesn't seem passive. It's actually very, very feels. The whole active-passive kind of distinction falls away. But there's this, it's really remarkable, the sense of being how fully you can feel engaged and present and energized and vitalized in this posture of meditation. You come alive, and sometimes it's almost impossible not to have the spine straightened out. We've had people sometimes when they get really present. This is why the cobra works so well, because sometimes my teacher in Burma, he told me one point, Gil, you get too concentrated. You have to throw away your concentration, get rid of your concentration. And I didn't know how to do it, because the concentration was a force that was kind of operating through me so powerfully. And there was, I had such a strong correlation between my posture and getting concentrated that I thought, oh, if I slump, then I can stop getting concentrated. So I just went like this. And within 5 or 10 minutes, my spine, my back would straighten itself up. And after years of, you know, Zen practice where I try to keep my back straight and keep it straight, I could not do it. It was like this energy was coursing through me, you know, locked in. And so, you know, it's just kind of an engagement energy. And so hopefully, I think as we get more mature in practice, the distinction between passive and active falls away. And the distinction between meditation and the world falls away. And, you know, we're cleaning house all the time. Either we're cleaning the house inside or cleaning the house outside. It's all cleaning house. Hopefully that wasn't a depressing analogy. So, thank you very much.